So it is with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce to you a man whose intellectual achievement I think is unparalleled in our time, and who on top of all that is an awfully nice fellow, René Girard.
When I come here, Gil says, oh, you don't have to do anything, you know. You just improvise and so on. And then, after such a build-up, you know, one feels a huge responsibility, you know. First, I should say something about him. I think the amazing thing about him is that he did not end up in a university. See what I mean? And it's your good luck. If he had ended up in a university, he'd be like as us, you know, as corrupted as the rest of us. And he's not. He's totally different. You know. But when I speak to a group of people such as you, I feel my position is a little bit ambiguous. Not that it is not ambiguous with scholars, you know, because scholars feel that my business should be to talk to people like you and not to them, that I have nothing to do with scholarship. But when people like you hear me, they feel that my business is really with the scholars. And I'm not quite the sort of fellow, you know, that can really deal with concrete problems. And one of my problems is that I'm very interested in religion, and I have no doubt that my interest has repercussions on daily life, on the religious crisis in which we are, but I feel I'm not quite competent to deal directly with the concerns that people have, you know, in their lives. Because my approach to Christianity is through other religions, anyway. The Western world is a very strange world, since we are the first to have created a worldwide civilization, you know, a civilization in which communication today is instantaneous in the entire world. But it has been that way since the great discoveries. Discovery of America and so forth. It's been a one world. In other words, a world in which religions have always been in contact with each other and have destroyed each other, very often force imperialism. We hear a lot about that today. But also because the comparison of religion is dangerous to them, makes people aware of their similarities. You know, and I really think that the great religious crisis in which we are today, which is very deep, very profound, but which goes way back to the 16th century, to the Protestant Reformation and even before, is tied up to this problem of how similar, how different religions are from each other, which is absolutely basic for Christianity, since Christianity is I am the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life. You see what I mean? Therefore, Christianity is greatly accused today for being intolerant, for claiming a superiority over all religions, which is unwarranted. Behind this feeling that it is unwarranted, there is the idea that all religions are sufficiently similar for no religion to be able to claim any fundamental superiority over the other ones. Therefore, there is the question, which has been with us really since the Renaissance and even before, of the similarity between what one calls myth, primitive archaic religion, and Christianity. You know, even great modern scholars of religion, when They tell you that certain things have become unbelievable in Christianity. They invoke science. People like Bultmann. I don't know if you talk about Bultmann here, but if you don't, maybe you don't miss that much. You know, so Bultmann said, you cannot believe in certain things in the day of the automobile and electricity or something like that, which is a very naive statement and a very European statement too. Because in Europe, for some strange reason, which in my view is mythical, the opposition between science and technology on one hand and religion on the other has been stronger than it is here. Here, religious faith and science have coexisted, in my view, with less problems than in Europe. But Bultmann is not really talking about the automobile and the electricity, because, or not even science fiction and travel between planets. You see, because when he says when he talks about what has become unbelievable in Christianity, he uses words like demythologisium, you know, to demythologize. Therefore, there are parts of Christianity which are mythological. What does that mean? You know, I think that the meaning of it is definable. And the meaning of it is definable. And as soon as you define it, you reach what is most central in Christianity, which is the passion of Christ and redemption, which is the relationship between the violence inflicted to Jesus and the notion of redemption. If you look at great myths, the Oedipus myth, you know, and so forth, you will see that in major myths, you have a central violence, which is followed by an epiphany of the god, revelation of the god. And very often, in many primitive cults, the god dies every year and is resurrected, like in the myth of Isis, Osiris, you know. And you will see that it's true all over the world. It's true of sacred kings, you know, who are killed and reborn. So, ultimately, even if we don't know anything about myth and primitive religion, we live in a world where we are all conscious, more and more, I think we have become through the centuries, of the similarities between myth. And we tend to say religion is mythical. Christianity must be mythical too. Therefore, it cannot claim, you know, some kind of superiority over other religions. And this view, you know, became dominant really at the end of the 19th century when the anthropologists, modern anthropologists, brought onto the market, the intellectual world, you know, all kinds of dying or already dead primitive cults from all the countries which were being explored and known at the time. You see, and sometimes the defense of Christianity vis-a-vis the religions one could call modern, surviving religions in our world, Judaism, the Muslim religion, Hinduism, maybe, Buddhism, religions or not religion, was, well, Christianity is the only one to have a god who is killed and resurrected, and the only religion in which God is not only all-powerful, but instead of being totally a god of majesty, you know, we're the only ones to have a god who suffers. In the 19th century, this was one of the ways of defending Christianity. That's why when suddenly the primitive cults and all these myths appeared, in which you always have a dying god who is resurrected, you see, the effect was enormous, really, at the end of the 19th century. People don't remember that today. But it's still with us. People felt at the time that there was going to be a theory of religion which would be like Darwin in biology, which would say so much about why people have all these religions which are alike, that it would show that Christianity is only one of them, one archaic religion among many. You find this argument all over the place. For instance, I was reading not too long ago, people like Elie Wiesel saying, look at the sacrifice of Abraham. This is the end of human sacrifice. Shift to animal sacrifice, which is quite true. Therefore, Christianity is regressive in relation to these religions, because in Christianity, the real son is killed, as if it were a sacred African monarchy. Or as in Sumer, you know, where the king was yearly reviled and an object of contempt to everyone, then was more or less reborn, you know, and recovered his power and everything. So this is the normal pattern of myth. I would say all myth is like that, deep down inside. There are many myths which have been so transformed that violence is not collective, as it is in the case of Jesus. You see? Nevertheless, I think through the Passion, you can see the centrality of that theme in mythology. And this the Christians have always been afraid of, because they have reasoned exactly like their opponents, which is always the case in intellectual struggles. They have thought, even though they didn't say so, we have to show the originality of Christianity. The originality in the modern sense. What is it to be original? As an artist, as a writer, it's to show your writing differently from anyone else. You invent new subjects. You say things which no one has said. You paint things which no one has painted. You see, you find harmonies or disharmonies that have never, no musician has ever tried. So the Christians have been very embarrassed by primitive religion when it showed up on the scene. Today this problem seems to be gone, because people say all religions are different from each other, each one has its difference, I embrace my difference, you embrace yours, we are multicultural, and so forth. But this, so we have no such problem anymore, and all this comparative religion was Western imperialism trying to understand everything which should not be understood anyway. Let all 100 flower blooms, like President Mao said, you see what I mean? And every religion has its little precinct. And Christianity should become aware that it is one religion among others, you know, and live in peace with its neighbors. All the progressive churches in liberal Protestantism, first in the 19th century, in the Catholic Church since Vatican Council, if you look at what they say, a certain notion of ecumenism, behind it, deep down inside, you have this view that Christianity is just as mythical as any other religion, you know, if you look at it strictly. You see, so I'm very, very interested in that, because I don't think it's true at all. And I think one can demonstrate that it is not true. But in order to demonstrate that it is not true, far from fleeing the similarity between mythical religions and Christianity, one has to meditate them and in a way emphasize them even more than they have been emphasized so far. You know? And one thing to do is, if you really look at traditional Christians, you know, they detest all comparisons. And to them, for instance, the Passion is absolutely unique in all respects, including as violence, which is very strange, since the Passion is crucifixion, which was the most common way of killing people in the Roman Empire. You know, the way of executing the worst kind of criminal, therefore which could not be unique. But the Christians, in a way, in reaction, instinctive reaction, through this idea of originality, have tried to show that the Passion in all respects must be totally different from other religions, which of course is not true. And anthropologists were right to say, not at all. And as a matter of fact, from a Christian point of view, if you start looking at the Gospels, you will see that it's not true at all. that the Gospels say the very reverse. When Jesus says, I will die like the prophets before me, what does it mean? What does that like mean? You know? And I think what I'm talking about now is connected in a way with another attack against Christianity, which is the idea that Christianity, that the Christians not only have been anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic, but that the Gospels themselves, by saying, I will die like the prophets, in other words, the Jewish people have been preparing to kill their Messiah because they are a particularly ferocious people, but this business about dying like the prophets has a value which is strictly limited to the Jewish world. If you start looking at the text, you will see it's not true at all. Because you have sentences, as you have in the synoptics, which talk about all the blood which is going to fall back on this generation, which has been shed, all the blood of the prophets, beginning with Abel the just, all over the earth, since the foundation of the world. So this since the foundation of the world means much more than the Jews. Abel is not a Jew. And all over the earth means more than the Jewish world. In other words, what the Gospels are talking about there is that the passion is like a certain type of violence which is universal and which is there since the foundation of the world. This universality is in John too. The words are different, but the meaning in my view is the same. The meaning seems so strange to us, you know, that we feel it's totally irrational, but I don't think it is. It's the devil was a murderer from the beginning. From the beginning, from arche, the beginning in Greek, means the same thing as the foundation of the world. It doesn't mean creation, but it means the foundation of the first culture. It means the death of Abel. If you look at the story of Cain, you will see there are two themes in the story of Cain. There is the death of Abel, and there is the creation of the first culture, because Cain is the founder of the first civilization on earth. And if you look at the text, you will see that these two things are one and the same. That in order to found the first civilization and the first religion with it, you have to kill your brother. In other words, I don't think that Cain is a myth, but Cain tells us the biblical conception of myth. Myth is a story in which you kill your brother, and a religion and a society is founded. In other words, if you see this, you see that the passion is infinitely close, and that Jesus himself tells us that there is a series of murder beginning with the foundation of the world, all over the earth, which cannot be only the Jews, which are like the passion. You see, so that like the passion, what does it mean? And I think in order to see what it means, you have to compare the death of Jesus to some of the deaths of the prophets in the Old Testament, which are very close. For instance, the suffering servant in the second Isaiah, you know, which is a very beautiful thing. And when people look at it, especially some of the Jewish scholars, they say it must be the model for the passion, because they realize it's very close. So they say maybe the authors of the passion invented the story of the passion, and they copied the suffering servant, because he's surrounded by a crowd, and he dies unjustly, like Jesus, and many aspects. But if you look at the text, you will see that there is a great similarity between the two, yet it's very hard to pin down immediately, because not one detail is the same. And in order to understand what to die like the prophets mean, there is another way of doing it, which is going to the New Testament itself. Because in the New Testament, you're supposed to have the last of the prophets. His name is John the Baptist. And what does he do in the Gospels? He dies. What sort of death he dies? A collective death, or a collectively inspired death, like the Passion. Very different from the Passion, since he's decapitated. Nevertheless, is it a death like Jesus? Yes.